CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Burnaby.
If we look at it from a global point of view, democracy is in retreat. The fraction of people living in democracies has gone markedly down. But I believe that democracy is the only way forward that will lead to broad, inclusive societal well-being. My view is that the failure of globalization, neoliberal globalization, created a fertile field for demagogues. That fertile field has now been tilled, and there are a host of demagogues, populists, and would-be authoritarians that have stepped in, not just in the United States, but in many countries around the world.
That's Joseph Stiglitz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Joseph Stiglitz on democracy and the failure of neoliberal globalization. Neoliberal economics has exposed the dark side of the American dream. It took off with Reagan and Thatcher. For most workers, incomes have stagnated, except for the very rich, whose incomes have more than quadrupled. Biden correctly points out that millions of people have gotten new jobs. But despite that, the typical family is actually getting paid less, taking inflation into account. According to data from the Federal Reserve, real median household income has been falling during the Biden presidency. Last year, the poverty rate more than doubled, and the number of people who are hungry jumped to 44 million. The ruling class, the owners of the economy and architects of policy, advance and protect their interests, no matter how grievous the effect on others. Can we imagine an equitable economic system? Our guest today is Joseph Stiglitz, university professor at Columbia. He's the recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics. He was senior vice president and chief economist of the World Bank. His efforts to move the bank in a more progressive direction got him fired. Author of many books, his latest is People, Power, and Profits. He spoke in Florence, Italy. And now, Joseph Stiglitz.
The neoliberal order that we had for the past 40 years nominally was based on premises of a well-functioning neoclassical economy. I say nominally because if you look underneath the surface, it was more based on power relationships. But what we tell our students, it's all about the neoclassical model, and that goes back to Adam Smith talking about taking advantage of economies of scale, the pin factory, the wider the market, the more those advantages. David Ricardo's talked about taking advantage of comparative advantage. Having free flow of factors meant factors go to where they are most productive, and that means GDP increases. All of this, as I say, leads to higher outputs, and that could make everyone better off. But there were multiple flaws in this analysis. Much of my work over the last 50 years has been to try to identify those flaws and to highlight them. It assumed away market imperfections, some of which are inherent, like imperfections in information and imperfect risk markets. You can say some imperfections are institutional. You might get rid of them, but you just can't solve the problem that there are always going to be imperfections of information. It ignored externalities with climate change, pandemic, public health issues. Externalities really are at the fore. It ignored technological change, and that's really remarkable. It was sort of an inconsistency, the rhetoric that was used for free markets. More broadly, once you introduce technological change, markets are not, in general, Pareto efficient. That's really important because a lot of people on the right don't refer to the first theorem of welfare economics. I never heard Barry Goldwater talk about the first welfare theorem. They talked about the dynamic properties of markets. But once you do that, actually, analytic economics says it's wrong. The next point is a really important one that many people ignored. Much of policy ignored what is called second-best economics. With multiple market failures, eliminating or reducing one market failure may actually lower welfare. And I'll give an example. And then finally, while the analysis said by maximizing GDP, everyone could be made better off, that is to say, you had a bigger pie, and if you sliced it correctly, everybody could get a bigger piece. In fact, anybody who looked at any political analysis, what actually happened was that some people wound up with a smaller slice, and they were worse off. So that meant it was not, in fact, Pareto efficient. So there are a whole set of theorems explaining why neoliberal globalization might not work. I'm embarrassed about being so self-referential, but it's true. The first is that the competitive equilibrium are not, in general, even constrained Pareto efficient. Constrained means take into account the market imperfections, the cost, the imperfect information, the cost of getting information, the cost of creating markets, and so forth. In the presence of incomplete risk markets and imperfect and asymmetric information, as I say, markets are just not efficient. And so the first welfare theorem is limited to a world that doesn't exist. So the way I sometimes put it is, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, that the pursuit of self-interest leads as if by an invisible hand to the well-being of everybody in society. The reason that the invisible hand often seems invisible, that is, it doesn't seem to be working, is because it's not there, and that the markets don't have that kind of property that Smith assumed. And then David Newberry and I showed in a paper that with imperfect risk markets, trade liberalization could make everyone in every country worse off. It wasn't only that there were distribution effects, it could make everybody worse off. And then I showed that with imperfect risk markets, capital market liberalization may be welfare decreasing. That was really important because one of my battles in life was with the IMF in 1997, where the IMF tried to change its charter to Articles of Agreement to allow it to push countries to have capital market liberalization. When the IMF was founded in 1944 with Keynes did not believe in capital market liberalization. He was adamantly opposed to it. So an institution that he helped create turned, as often you create institutions, and then, 20 years later, the people running them stab you in the back and go in the opposite direction. And that's what happened at the IMF. And at the point right after I became chief economist of the World Bank, that was on their agenda. There was a Hong Kong meeting where they were going to ratify this change to allow them to push capital market liberalization. Well, the events turned out not well because the East Asia crisis was just beginning. It began in Thailand in September. I met with all the finance ministers and tried to get them to put on tougher capital controls, undermining the IMF. But before we could get all organized to do it, the Indonesian crisis and then the Korean crisis, and so we had a full-blown crisis. So The point is, I opposed it in part because I thought there was no analytic foundations for it, that it was not welfare increasing. I finally, you know, gave the proof of it in a paper in 2008. And then finally, you know, bringing on innovation, which is central to modern economies, with learning by doing market equilibrium is essentially never efficient. So those were some of the theorems that help us understand why you should not have expected neoliberal globalization to have worked. But actually, in practice, things were worse. And they were worse because these were theorems, and then you talk about what are the numbers, and the efficiency gains were smaller than predicted, and the distributive effects were larger. And large groups in our society became worse off with very strong political consequences. And this has to do with something else I didn't point, you know, some of the other assumptions. One of the assumptions of neoliberal economics, neoclassical economics, is costless mobility, intersectoral, across places. Some of the work of people like Samoglu and the MIT group show that in those places where there were big trade shocks, wages went down, unemployment increased, property values went down, showing, in fact, that there were local effects. People did not move freely. In work with Bruce Greenwald, we had theoretically analyzed what happens then, and you can get, again, very bad outcomes from a macroeconomic point of view. Moreover, the trade agreements that were part of the neoliberal agenda, called free trade agreements, Europe, you often call them partnership agreements, but neither vocabulary describes what they were. A free trade agreement would be very short. Free trade means I don't have any tariffs, you don't have any tariffs, I don't have any subsidies, you don't have any subsidies, and that's it. I would say, you know, a free trade agreement would be three pages. Free trade agreements are sometimes thousands of pages long. Why? They're managed trade agreements with all kinds of special provisions. No free trade agreement really included agriculture and special interest. That was the only area where you could have subsidies. If you looked at it, it was managed for the benefits of large corporations and powerful countries. The international institutions reflected the same power dynamics. For instance, the intellectual property provision, which played a big role in the pandemic, reflected the interest of Big Pharma. And I saw that very clearly because the TRIPS provision reflected the U.S. view I saw firsthand was driven by Big Pharma and the entertainment industry. So copyright, we talk about it being really law, was the Mickey Mouse bill because it was intended to extend the property rights of Mickey Mouse. And the IMF reflected the interest of the larger creditor countries. I often refer to it as the credit collecting agency of the rich countries. Well, there are a series of events that began in the early part of this century to undermine neoliberal globalization. The 2008 financial crisis showed that financial globalization integration meant that mismanaged financial markets in one country could lead to a global crisis. So it undermined the faith in free capital flows. The 2017, we found Trump showed that powerful countries could rip up the rules at will. He just said, I don't care about the WTO. And it was even worse than that. He refused to allow the appointment of the judges at the WTO. So it basically shut down the appellate body at the WTO. And then Biden passed the IRA, the most massive subsidy ever. When it was passed, Europeans are beginning to complain about it, but I'll explain. People in the developing countries and emerging markets are really complaining about it even more, even though it had a good purpose. Its purpose was to advance investment in green. But it led to an unlevel playing field. The magnitude was originally, it was supposed to be a $270 billion subsidy, but it was a tax credit, so it was uncapped. And Brookings estimated it a little while ago that it was over $1 trillion. But when I was recently in Brazil, they were complaining that their estimates are $1.5 trillion. That's a lot of money, and a country like Brazil obviously can't compete. So these are some of the events. Probably more dramatic was what happened in the pandemic, because in the pandemic, the global IPR rules made it impossible for countries in the South to get access to vaccines and therapeutics and tests. There was supply shortages, and there was a capacity, not great, but some capacity in the developing countries for producing it. And there would have been more if there had been a tech transfer. South Africa and India, at the very beginning of the pandemic, asked for a vaccine waiver. It wasn't a change in the legal framework, because when the WTO was created, there was a provision for compulsory licenses, particularly relevant in epidemics, let alone a pandemic. And even the U.S. had used that, or had talked about using it in one instance. The problem was the compulsory licenses, the drug companies had figured out how to drag their feet. And in the case of the pandemic, it was very important to act quickly. You didn't want to wait 5 years of litigation to get your license. So that was the reason for the waiver. It wasn't, you still pay a royalty, so the drug companies get compensated, but at a fair market rate, not a monopoly rate. But the drug companies wanted to be compensated at a monopoly rate. And the disappointing thing was that the drug companies owned several of the European countries. Germany, I couldn't even get the SPD to change their policy. We got the Greens to change, but not the SPD. Of course, you didn't expect the FD to change. But we did get Biden to support the vaccine waiver. But without the support of Germany, UK, Switzerland, the vaccine waiver didn't occur. People died. People were hospitalized. Thousands and thousands unnecessarily because of this. And this has led a legacy of anger in the developing countries and emerging markets. There was another aspect of where globalization didn't work the way it should have. There are rules about not exporting, hoarding, putting export restraints. Right now, Europe is complaining about some export restraints that Indonesia has imposed on the export of nickel, because Indonesia is trying to increase, move up the value chain, and not just be a primary producer. It wants to end the neocolonial relationship. And Europe says, no, you have to maintain your neocolonial relationship and export raw nickel. So that's a current debate. But in the pandemic, the United States refused the export of key ingredients for the vaccines. So there was a lot of vaccine hoarding. So that led to what was called vaccine apartheid. There were other aspects of the imbalances that became very evident in terms of the support for the economies. One of the big things is showing that government mattered, but also the market economies showed remarkable lack of resilience. The supply chains were very fragile. I thought that all of that was predictable. It was related to the short-termism of market economies and the way that market economies don't appropriately value risk. We can talk about it more formally, what the market failure is, but it was a predictable market failure. There is the new geopolitics and geoeconomics. There's a new Cold War highlighted by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, just a blatant violation of international law. But even more important from the American point of view is the growing split with China. It's the only thing that Democrat and Republicans agree on is that China's bad. People may differ about what thing about China they dislike, but that the view that this, we ought to be tough on China is almost universal. So universal that I think people are afraid who don't really believe it even to speak up. So there's a kind of conformity going on. Each side, Democrats and Republicans, are pushing the other to take stronger stronger action. It's not clear what the reason for this is, in the sense that at this point, China hasn't done a lot to deserve this kind of treatment. Graham Allison has written a book about what's called the Thucydides trap, the idea that the number one country doesn't like to become number two. There's a lot of evidence of that being relevant. Partly it has to do with China's support for Russia in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There's explicit Chinese aggression in the South China Sea. And probably most relevant is China's threat to take over Taiwan. One of the senior Chinese leaders met with me and said our accord with Nixon was the peaceful reunification. And you in the West always talk about peaceful, and we always talk about reunification. And a very clear hint that there would be reunification, whether peaceful or not. The old vocabulary is friendshoring. Janet Yellen gave that in one of her speeches. But she never defined friend. One of the Latin American, large Latin American countries came up to me and said, said he went to Yellen and said, are we a friend or not? And she was evidently a little surprised at the question, hadn't really defined who is a friend and not, and therefore who gets that benefit of friendshoring. Europe has a much better vocabulary, and I think a very relevant one. They talk about de-risking. So the hoarding of COVID-19 products showed that borders did matter at a very critical time. But now, with the potential breakup of the global system, borders again matter. And if China were to invade, and you have to give some probability to that, were to invade Taiwan, that would entail major changes in patterns of trade. So if you know that's a serious risk, what action do you take today? Again, emphasizing that borders matter. Well, a couple of other factors undermining neoliberal globalization I'll talk about very quickly. The massive externality associated with climate change. But the problem is that this is a major social cost which is not incorporated into market prices. So every country is engaged in subsidizing. And so anybody who says market prices reflect real costs have forgotten about a major first order subsidy that every government around the world is, and we don't have a good way of measuring the relative magnitude of subsidy. So the whole basis that market economics is supposed to be a balance of having free markets reflect real costs, we now know with this massive externality, they don't. So that really undermines the basis of free trade. But the actions that Europe are now trying to take against the emerging markets, like saying we won't import palm oil from deforested land, are greatly resented and asymmetric. You know, a natural question is, well, a lot of your agriculture is on deforested land. You just deforested it a long time ago. So why should you prioritize old deforestation with new deforestation? It's just another way of the West trying to take advantage of the others. Well, there's still other drivers of change of globalization, the changing structure of the economy towards services, and there are many distinct aspects of services. I want to move on quickly to the second part of the talk, where I address the question of global trade with learning by doing and climate change. The experiences that we have raise the question of whether there can really be an international rule of law in the presence of powerful countries. An example I gave earlier illustrates. But a rule of law is still really important for the less powerful countries. So you have the irony right now is that many of the advocates of the rule of law is not the United States, because it's breaking it, but smaller countries who want to be protected against big countries beating them up, or other smaller countries trying to engage. That's really the context. So in the next few minutes, I want to discuss a special case of trade systems in the presence of learning by doing. And the big point I want to make is that the equilibrium outcomes are likely to differ markedly from output or welfare-maximizing outcome. And the hopeful note is that cooperation among medium-sized countries and competition from large powers, which we are seeing today, for support of the other countries may enable the creation of a more balanced system than would otherwise be the case. So the basic idea is, if you have learning by doing, where the learning occurs based on your own production, and I'll take the extreme case, you can't transmit the knowledge across borders, but you can transmit dollars across borders, what does it look like? Well, the obvious solution is you have the innovation occur in the places where innovation is easiest. You need to look for the comparative advantage in innovation. And then you transfer the dollars. But, of course, we don't have a system of easy transfers across borders. So that leads to a question of what would the equilibrium really look like. Before getting in there, I want to talk about a pie-in-the-sky idea. If you wanted to talk about just or fair trading system in this context, how would you think about it? How would you begin to think about it? And I like to think about it in terms of Rawls' theory of justice. And you ask, behind a veil of ignorance, where you don't know which country you were going to be born in, but you had to adopt a set of international rules that you would have to obey no matter where you were born, what set of rules would you want to have? We could describe that precisely. You know, it would be, again, where you would have efficient distribution of innovation, but widespread redistribution of the income that's generated by that optimal research and learning experience. Those are all, you might call pie in the sky. And then I want to look at two other cases. One is the decentralized solution with constrained power. And the constrained power, all I mean by that, is where the countries that sign the agreement obey them. Not like the United States or Europe, but where if you, say, sign on to the WTO, you actually obey the rules. The equilibrium, of course, will be the powerful countries will set international rules that maximize their expected welfare. Investment in the innovation will not be optimally allocated. There'll be rules, IPR rules, that benefit the advanced countries at the expense of the less developed countries. And, in fact, inequalities will be perpetuated and magnified. But that's not as bad as the next two cases. One is where where instead of having the powerful countries obey the rules, you have the powerful countries not obey the rules. And that's really the situation we have. And the equilibrium entails abuse of power, and powerful countries set the international rules, knowing that if the rules